Anne-Marie Hamming is the author of the recently released memoir titled Saving Lee, Finding Grace, A Mother's Journey. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Earlene.
Your elementary school son, Lee, has a rare autoimmune condition that required a bone marrow transplant. It took 3 years of countless doctor's visits to get a diagnosis. The pressure of juggling your son's health issues and a demanding newspaper career caused you to quit your job so that you can care for him full time, a decision that you made when your financial future was uncertain because you're about to get a divorce. You say in the book that you had always planned a life for yourself as a career woman where motherhood was a part of it and not all of it. You honestly talk about that in the book.
Yes, I do. It really created an identity crisis for me because suddenly I was in a spot where I felt like I had thrown away half of who I was, or more than half of who I was, for a full-time job with kids. And it was greatly uncertain for us financially, personally, what the next step would be and how we would get out of it. But it was also very, very clear to me that I couldn't continue doing both. And obviously, my son's health trumped everything. So I took the plunge and became a full-time mother, not knowing where it would go.
What has been the hardest part of caring for a severely ill child?
The hardest part early on was not knowing. We took all kinds of measures with diet and skincare and all kinds of doctor's appointments and medications, but we still didn't know. He wouldn't get better. He would improve somewhat, but never completely get better. So the most difficult part was the uncertainty early on. Later on, it's been just the endurance of of hanging in there for years, because when they say a bone marrow transplant recovery is a minimum of 2 years, they aren't kidding. So it's an endurance.
It's interesting that you should talk about endurance, because my next question has to do with how did you keep your sanity? Being a single parent of two, you know, during these 3 years of mysterious symptoms, your son in and out of the doctor's office or hospitalized?
Yes, I kept my sanity a number of ways. It took a lot of self-care to do it. And it took a lot of reflection and candor. I had to be very, very honest with myself that I had to start living differently. And so I let my kids show me how, actually, with teaching me how to lighten up again, because somewhere in the process of growing up, I had kind of forgotten how to play. I had been so serious, and I had worked so hard that I had forgotten the importance of rest and quiet time and taking care of my body. I thought that my brain was more important than my body, and so I beat myself up with shorting it of sleep. So really, my kids dialed my life back to the fundamentals, the basics of adequate rest, exercise, playfulness, and laughter. Because at every point where I was miserable and tired and scared to death, something would happen. My kids would get me to do something fun, and I would start to laugh. And that was really the key for me when I started to untangle it, that, oh, gee, these things I was too busy to really participate in before, just suddenly, oh, hold on, this is the way to something. And so I decided to go that route and dove in there.
What you're talking about is a coping strategy. And you've come up with your own, and you have an acronym for it, a coping strategy for dealing with severe illness and major life changes. And you call it HEALS, as in HEALS. Tell us about that.
Well, I stepped back when I was writing my book. It was certainly not an advice book. Above all, my book is just a compelling story that so many families go through. We're just one example of families who cope with these challenging situations. But I stepped back to go, what were the things that helped me through? And one, the main one, H, for hold a vision. When I would get despondent, I would say, hold on, look 20 years in the future, or vision. Someday when my son is cured and he's going to be taller than me and he's going to be a beautiful young man, and that would help me just let go of the momentary frustration and get to the next E, which is embrace the situation. I realized I was fighting my life and hating it and saying, why me? Why am I in this situation? And that just made me miserable. So I said, well, I'll try the opposite. And I embraced it. And the beauty of embracing it was the tension just whooshed out of my life, and I could be very present to my son and see that even though he was very ill and we had many challenges, at the core, he was still a little boy and a really funny little boy who just wanted to play and engage with his mother and all the people in his life. So thank you.
And the other, the A and the L and the S.
Sure. Uh-huh. The A is assess. The A means assess where you are. Just because you have lost some things, you also have gained some things. And so assess your losses, certainly grieve them, but also look at what you gained. In my case, you know, I lost a career and a livelihood, but I did gain many opportunities to be with my kids and to chill out and start taking care of my body. I think I took years, you know, I added years to my life with that decision. The L is to look up, look around you, and let your kids lead you. When you're feeling really down, look up, and you will see somebody else who has been in the situation, and you will see your kids who just want to be kids and are saying, hey, don't get stuck in this muck, mother. Come out and play with us. And then the last one is really important, the self-care of when you're in these trying situations. It's so important to get enough rest, eat nutritious foods, exercise, even if it's just a short walk, and take time for friends, for hobbies, because you still matter too. Without you, you know, the parents in these situations, without you, the whole, you know, the bus comes to a screeching halt. So you got to take care of yourself.
Why did you write this book?
Several reasons. One, I did not want to forget this time in our lives. It shaped us, and it will continue to shape my family. I didn't want to forget the lessons that I learned about slowing down, savoring, and really just embracing the present as it is, even when it looks really, really, really crummy, because there was so much beauty and there was so much joy, and that was the lesson for me. And also, I wanted to honor all the families like mine. You know, we kind of silently soldier on, whether we're parents of autistic kids. My son is still diabetic, even though he's cured of his underlying autoimmune condition, asthma, food allergies, disabilities. There are so many families like mine that would just quietly soldier on. And it was sort of a way to say, hey, you know, we can honor these families and have a little better understanding of these families and all it takes for many of these families just to function in terms of getting to school, getting through the school day without meltdowns, and just getting through the week. You know, that in itself is success for thousands of families, including mine.
You talk about silently soldiering on, and that brings me actually to my next question. We once worked together as editors at a newspaper here in Kalamazoo, and I had no idea at the time of your home situation, really, until I'm reading actually this book. Did you find that it was important to keep a brave front of normalcy? And is there a point at which individuals in your kind of situation or anyone that faces a life challenge that you take that mask off at some point?
Oh, yes, indeed. Early on, it was important to keep the mask, to keep the facade, because remarkably, one important thing is that work was one area where I could go in my life and things got accomplished, questions got answered, and to feel like things were getting done was really important. That was one area where I could experience that. But that said, I did get tired of having the facade. It did wear me out. And yeah, I got to the point when I had left the career and I was home with my kids and I felt like I had nothing left but my two kids, my good health, thank goodness, and a good credit score. I felt like, wow, I'm down to the bare minimum, the bare basics. And that's when life became very real and all desire for any pretense just fell away. And I just had to go, wow, huh, isn't this something? And I couldn't be what I was anymore. So I was just in the present and just, yeah, I embraced it.
Your book poignantly lays out how your son's illness led to having to be separated from your eldest child, a daughter, for about 15 months. She went to go live with your parents during the times that your son was hospitalized for his bone marrow transplant and during his at-home post-recovery, and that there were times when she was angry at you and she was distant. How did you all work past that, and how are things now?
Well, first of all, things are quite good now. They are, you know, typical brother and sister. Sometimes they love each other. Sometimes they hate each other. How we worked through it, I had to be very honest with myself going into that phase of reuniting my family. I'm very honest about the fact that we still had a lot of work to do. By that point, we had been through months and months of medical isolation. My son was just able to get out with other children, get out to play, and we were just then able to get out into the world and do things like going to parks and going to the beach. And it would have been really easy for me to say, wow, phew, the drama's over, the crisis is done, let's just get back to normal. And I had to be very honest that they had some wounds in their heart to heal. My son's body was better, but their hearts were not better. And it took a great commitment to just be home with them and be with them, to be very, very consistent with them, to be with them through their meltdowns and embrace them and accept them and say, yeah, it's what a raw deal. What a raw deal, honey. I'm so sorry. And to also set some very, very clear expectations for their behavior and how we would treat one another. I had to, you know, make those plainly clear with, you know, clear consequences, but also a lot of nurture and one-on-one time with them. So we had many months of staying close to home, and I knew our time to get out in the world more and have more lightness and more freedom would come. And fortunately it did, and it didn't take long. It came about much more quickly than I thought. That was about a four-month process for us when we became, you know, a cohesive family again.
And there's also been an impact on your son besides just physically. You talk about the medical isolation that was necessary at times to keep him healthy. And the result, and you talk about this very honestly in your book, that there was it affected his emotional development because he wasn't around other children much. You describe him as being several years, being immature for his age. And even at times also being aggressive due to him having to take steroids as part of his treatment at one point. And that must have been difficult. You talk about how he once hit you, even bit you, and it's leaving a faint scar today. And you also talk about how, you know, it's easy. People see children out having a temper tantrum, and they have no idea what parents might be dealing with. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. I felt very strongly about that. I realized that, you know, my son had been so sick when he was little. He was extremely passive. And then when he was on the steroids, all of a sudden, wow, he had energy like he had never known before. And I had never seen this aggressive boy before. And I realized, first of all, how, oh, wow, I think I've judged other parents when I've seen their kids flipping out. And it was all of a sudden like, oh, wow, what a hypocrite am I? Because now if we were out in public and my child was doing this, I think of all the people who would be judging me. And it really opened my eyes to how quickly we judge other parents without even knowing their situations. There could be a learning disability. There could be some medication. There could be, you know, transitions. Maybe a family's going through a divorce or the loss of a grandparent. We have no idea what families are going through, and kids only have meltdowns a lot of times to show us what pain they are feeling, or sometimes they just simply are not equipped, especially little children. All they have is really strong emotion that they don't know how to control yet because they haven't lived long enough to learn how to do that. So, it was very quickly, again, I saw, wow, I had my work cut out for me. And I was grateful that he was so isolated so that we could work through those tantrums without that extra layer of feeling of being judged or risking that. So
the other thing that strikes me as I read the book is the financial toll that severe illness puts on a family. And I was just curious, in your experience, you know, what kind of economic toll does families tend to go through when their child has a bone marrow transplant in particular? You know, where are they getting the money from that you have found? I mean, do most of these families tend to be covered? Do they go bankrupt as a result of this type of thing?
You know, they could, or I would have been forced to return to work full time, you know, before my kids were really, really ready for it. It does take a tremendous toll. And it's not just my family. I mean, families of many chronically ill children face this when it goes on for years and years and years. And fortunately, in our case with the bone marrow transplant, the insurance covered things quite well. And also, what people don't realize in the state of Michigan is that some children with some chronic conditions get a secondary insurance through the Michigan Children's Special Health Fund. And I can't emphasize enough how important that is and how important funding is for that, for the extensive travel that is involved for families like mine, the lodging costs that can be involved for families like mine. And that doesn't even begin to cover food when you're away. When we talk about, you know, government programs, that program is so important for families of chronically ill kids because there is an expense. And I am not able to work that kind of hours I worked before. Even now, it's greatly limited. And so fortunately, I had great support from my family through it all. And also the children's father fortunately has good employment. So there's, you know, good health insurance and child support that is able to be there, too. But yeah, you piece it together and it gets pretty skinny sometimes. And it's a tough reality that goes along with the medical realities.
You also mention in the book about a Medicaid benefit that is available to pay for medical expenses of chronically ill children, even if families have insurance. Can you elaborate? And is that benefit still available?
Yeah, that benefit is. And that is the Michigan Children's Special Health Program. It's administered or funded through Medicaid. And it is. It covers the co-pays. And so, you know, because otherwise that expense for me would be significant when I look at my son. He has medical appointments every month that we would be required to, you know, $40 here, $75 there. You know, it adds up. And prescriptions, you know, there was a time where he was on 10 prescriptions a month, and it gradually has been whittled down. But even for a diabetic child with good health insurance, you could be looking at $75 a month out of pocket at a minimum. And so this covers those kinds of things for families. And for me, you know, $75 a month on prescription copays would be a lot. And that would, like I say, that would be a light month. So it's very important for families like mine to have that.
By having you speak out and write your book, this becomes really an educational experience for other families who may be going through this. Were there other types of resources available to severely ill children and their families that you were surprised to find out about, that you stumbled upon?
The funny thing was I hit a lot of dead ends. Because my son's illness was so rare, I found that I couldn't really click in and connect with, you know, the leukemia groups or, you know, the diabetes groups. I'm like, well, okay, you're just talking about diabetes here, but I have all these food concerns going on. I have skin concerns. I have anemia going on. My kid just doesn't quite fit this picture either. So those groups would have been helpful if he had been a little less complicated. The most supportive people I found were the people in the transplant unit themselves, other parents who have been through bone marrow transplants with their children, regardless of the illness. Then suddenly we were speaking the same language. We had made the same decisions to go all out and do whatever we could for our kiddos. And that's where I really found the support. And we instantly, even to this day, when when I meet people who have been through a transplant themselves or have seen a child through one, you know, we immediately can have a great conversation and there's a level of understanding and support there.
Aside from your book, have you become active on the bone marrow transplant issue in other ways, or is there a particular issue that you champion at this time?
Oh, at this time, right now, I try to raise awareness of the Be the Match program. So I strongly encourage people to go to the website bethematch.org and join the National Bone Marrow Registry if you are able to. There are health restrictions, and there is some expense if you are beyond a certain age. But by all means, go there. Or if you go to a blood drive, you can ask about joining the registry at a blood drive. And also, I support the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation with volunteerism to work for a cure for type 1 diabetes, because as I say, we've cured Lee of, you know, the first illness that was killing him, but we still have one more to go. The bone marrow transplant did not cure him of the type 1 diabetes, which even though it was caused by his underlying autoimmune condition.
You and I had an offline conversation, and you were indicating that your book actually would speak to people not only if they've had children that are chronically ill, but could speak to people on many different levels. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. It's been interesting to hear people talk about their own losses or their own victories after they've come through, really, really trying times. They talk about their parents, perhaps losing their parents. They've talked about their own illnesses, their cancers, siblings. It's been really interesting to hear how people have been touched in so many ways by losses, whether it was raising kids on their own without expecting it. Yeah, cancer, losing parents, losing someone in car accidents. It hits a spot. And two, people are really touched by the chapter on my daughter, because I poignantly talk about, the pain of having to send my daughter to live with my parents, because I had to honestly acknowledge that I was not in a position where I could care for her. And that really, I'm not quite sure why, but people just say, oh, that chapter on your Katie just touched my heart so deeply.
You have some author visits coming up here in Kalamazoo.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. I will be at Barnes & Noble on April 6th from 2 to 4 p.m. And I will be at Kazoo 2 Books on their Parkview location from 1 to 3 p.m. on April 13. And both days at 2 p.m., I'm giving a short presentation on some of the themes of the book, and I'm calling it Seriously, Lighten Up.
All righty. Well, I know the good and positive news in your book is that your son has been integrated into school, and mm-hmm. he attends school now. So that's a wonderful thing. Also, I noticed that you're doing some life coaching.
Yes, I am. I am. I found that people were intrigued by my experiences, and from those, they would ask, you know, how did you get through it? And I realized that I had a really credible foundation there for, first of all, just being with people when they were in a challenging time. What drew me to life coaching was all the times I didn't want advice. I didn't want people offering me solutions. I just wanted somebody who could listen and just be supportive in that. And life coaching at its foundation really is that, in offering a safe, judgment-free zone for people to just let their guard down and explore what they really think about things and come up with some of their own solutions. Because, again, life coaching, you trust the client that they can reach their own solutions. They just need a little support or some tools to get there and to come up with a plan. So, my experience has really helped me there to take off in a life coaching.
As we close, I'm just going to open up the mic to you and say, what are some final thoughts you'd like to share?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for the chance to talk about my book. And I hope that somebody out there says, oh, yeah, I totally agree with that. Or, wow, I really like her approach to things. And really, at the the darkest times, the most challenging times, look for the lightness, because that's all there too. Life is a beautiful, mysterious paradox at times. And I just remember the times when my son, even at his sickest, could laugh, and the sparkle in his eye of even the sickest children. They just want to be kids, and they just want to engage in life, and they provide a vision for us to be able to do the same as adults. So thank you.
It occurs to me, do you have a website?
Yes,
or anything?
Yes, I do have a website. It's just my name, Anne Hamming, AnneHamming.com.
Anne, again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Arlene.